welcome to the Theology Mill podcast brought to you by Whipfenstock Publishers. My name is Zach Mickle. I am the digital marketing manager and an associate acquisitions editor here at Whipfenstock. I'm also the host of this podcast, which consists of interviews with leading authors and thinkers in theology, biblical studies, and philosophy. If you like what you're hearing on our podcast, you can also stop by our website at whipfenstock.com. And while you're there, you can browse our catalog. You can also check out our blog while you're there too. So in this conversation, I got to sit down with Dr. Stephen E. Knepper and Father Ryan G. Duns to talk about Steve's new edited collection, A Heart of Flesh, William Desmond and the Bible, to which Father Ryan was a chapter contributor. So Steve is an associate professor of English at the Virginia Military Institute. He is the author as well of Wonder Strikes, Approaching Aesthetics and Literature with William Desmond, and the co-author of the forthcoming Byung-Chul Han, A Critical Introduction. Father Ryan is a Jesuit priest and an associate professor of theology at Marquette University. He is the author of Spiritual Exercises for a Secular Age, Desmond's Quest for God, as well as the forthcoming Theology of Horror, The Hidden Depths of Popular Films. So with that, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Okay, so I am here with Stephen E. Knepper and Father Ryan G. Duns. Steve is the editor of A Heart of Flesh, William Desmond and the Bible, which just came out with us at Cascade a couple months ago. And then Father Ryan is a contributor to that volume. Both of them have also authored single author monographs on Desmond. So they both are very immersed in the work of William Desmond. So it's lovely to have you both on. Thanks very much for coming on the Theology Mill. As we are kind of kicking off our conversation, could each of you just share maybe a bit about yourself, what you do for work, and then if you want to, maybe kind of what research areas you're most interested in. So we'll start with Steve, and then we can jump to Father Ryan.
Sure, and thank you for having us on today to talk about the book. So I teach in the Department of English Rhetoric and Humanistic Studies at Virginia Military Institute in Lexington, Virginia. And my background is in literature and in American literature. But over the course of my graduate studies, actually at the very end, I discovered Desmond's Account of Wonder, and it just kind of drew me in. And so a lot of my work since grad school has been on Desmond. And often I am bringing him into conversation with literary texts that I teach, like Moby Dick. But I have kind of an unusual path to Desmond. But also my emphasis in my studies of him tends to be on aesthetics and literature. So kind of coming at him from that angle.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you. Father Ryan, how about you?
So I am an associate professor at Marquette University, and I'm the chair-elect of the theology department. I don't know what I did to merit such punishment in life, but there we have it. I came to Desmond fairly early, even before I began doctoral studies in theology. And as part of my Jesuit formation, we received a master's degree in philosophy. And I was well exposed to mystic metaphysics at Fordham University. And so I was already formed, St. Thomas, Karl Rahner, and I was open to the pursuit of metaphysical inquiry. And it was a lock and key moment when I started to read Desmond. And I felt everything within me sort of coalesce around this whole new vocabulary and way of framing the world. And that has certainly influenced what I teach and how I teach. So I did a book on, as my dissertation, the book on Desmond and spiritual exercises. I've published articles on Desmond, and I have just finished, and it will come out in 2024, a book called The Theology of Horror, which is the first book-length treatment of working out the theological depths of contemporary horror cinema. So it's really meant to be a book that teachers want to teach and that students would actually want to read as a primer in theological and philosophical thinking. And Desmond figures strongly in that.
Sounds fascinating. Yeah, he does some stuff with horror and Nietzsche, I know, so I'm sure he can get roped into that. Okay, let's kick things off with our icebreaker question. Steve, I know you have been on the Hermetics podcast, so you know better than anybody else that I'm totally stealing this question from James, but you know, it's very much a sign of honor because that podcast is fantastic. But so let's kick off with our icebreaker question. So if you could place any three thinkers, dead or alive, together in a room with William Desmond, so he's already placed in the room, and you could kind of be a fly on the wall and listen into their conversation, who would you choose and why? And let's kick off with Father Ryan this time, and then we'll go to Steve.
Sure. I love this question. And I've been trying to come up with a nice configuration. I think I would put Desmond in with the poet Denise Levertov, with the British novelist and philosopher Iris Murdoch, and my hero Karl Rahner. And the reason is not just to have parity in the sexes, but you have four persons each coming at some of the great existential questions that every one of us faces, the mystery at the heart of human existence, what it means to be a human, a deep sensitivity to the poetics of human existence. And I would love to allow the four of them to converse about the matters of the heart, how we arrive and articulate those movements within us, the dynamism of human longing and human knowing, the experiences of wonder, of astonishment. And I could just see, despite, especially with Iris Murdoch, the most religious atheist one you're going to come upon on the long day's walk, I think there'd be a really interesting probing of the metaphysical substrate of being itself. And I think that'd just be phenomenal to be an eavesdropper on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not as familiar with Levertov, but definitely, you know, with Murdoch and with Desmond too, there's such a rich exploration of ethics and of otherness too. So that could be a really interesting strand, I feel like, in that conversation as well. Okay, Steve, how about you? Who would you put in the room?
Yeah, so I like that lineup. So maybe my three could just crash the party, and that might make it even more exciting. So I'd go back to the early 20th century for two of my thinkers I'd add. One is Gabriel Marcel, who's someone that I have worked on a good bit. And Marcel's definitely an influence on Desmond. Marcel's one of these early 20th century kind of existentialist personalists, doesn't like any of the labels that come with that, but that's what he's up to. Taking philosophy back to first person experience and trying to have a non-reductive account of experience. He has this great distinction between problems and mysteries. A problem is something that you can solve with kind of a universalizable formula, right? It's a one size fits all solution. But a mystery is something that is bound up in your existence, in particular to your situation, and has to be navigated through those particularities. So in modernity, we're very good at solving technical problems, but what we've lost is a sense that many of the key things in life, like love, like confronting death, like confronting evil, those are more mysteries. That they don't have this one-size-fit-all situation. There's something we have to navigate in their particularities. There's something excessive about them, and something that calls for wisdom rather than just some sort of technical know-how. And I think that that's had a big influence on Desmond. But also, Marcel is very wary of any kind of systematization. So it'd be interesting to see how Desmond sort of develops some of his themes in a much more systematic direction, whether Marcel would like that, whether he'd quibble with that. And he's just a great debater and dialogue partner. So I think he would be really fun in such a conversation. And someone that is not so well known, but was an acquaintance of Marcel's, is Rachel Bezbaloff, who's another one of these kind of hard to classify early 20th century figures that are coming out of that kind of confluence of kind of personalist streams, existentialist streams, phenomenology. And Bezbaloff is best known in English because she published an essay on the Iliad that's really powerful around the same time as Simone Weil's famous essay. And what's interesting there is that she stages a conversation between the Iliad and the Bible as part of that essay. And it's just a really, it's a wonderful piece of writing, and reflects a really dynamic three-dimensional view of the human in a way that I think Desmond would resonate with. But I think that she would be a really interesting conversation partner too. And then someone who's more of Desmond's generation, but sadly died a couple of years ago, would be Jean-Louis Chrétien, the French phenomenologist, who has also done a lot of really profound work on the Bible, and in many ways is much more directly engaged and consistently engaged with the Bible than Desmond himself is. The Bible is certainly important for Desmond, but it's not the focal point as frequently for him as it is for Chrétien. And also you'd get the chance to have the conversation between a very sort of phenomenologically sensitive metaphysics in Desmond's case, and I'd say a metaphysically friendly, but much more straightforwardly phenomenological approach with Chrétien.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like to imagine it, you know, all six or I guess it'd be seven of these people together as well, with one party crashing another. But I kind of like to imagine Marcel kind of hosting, because, you know, just because of his, you know, his history of hosting those Friday seminars. Yeah. Okay. So for our listeners who aren't as maybe familiar with Desmond, or is familiar with his work, could you tell us a little bit about William Desmond and his thinking? I know there's a lot there, so it's hard to do briefly. But how would you describe him to others, maybe as kind of a thought exercise, if you were at sort of like an academic dinner reception or speaking with a colleague who doesn't know about him? How would you kind of describe Desmond? I'll let whoever wants to go chime in first.
So maybe I'll start with something kind of broad, and then Father Ryan can add to it however he'd like. But I think that Desmond is a non-reductive and capacious philosopher. He wants to give an account of being, but whereas metaphysics has been sort of a bad word in philosophy, especially continental philosophy, for quite a while, sort of post Heidegger, if not post Nietzsche, Desmond would agree with all of the concerns you have with Heideggerians about reducing being to a standing reserve, about sort of systematizing being metaphysically in a way that's reductive, that you lose the sense of the mystery of being. But Desmond would say that the answer to those kind of modern malaises is not to abandon metaphysics, it's to do metaphysics better. And so his metaphysics is always an open system that attends to the excess, or what the phrase he often uses, the too muchness of being, right? So even at the level of our everyday negotiations of the world, there's always more going on than we can sort of take in, process, pin down. We live in this world of excess. We ourselves are an excess that we cannot fully comprehend. We can grasp bits of it, but there's always more. This sense of there always being more is a major kind of impulse of Desmond's philosophy, and something he tries to honor throughout, right? Even as he's also very much a careful thinker that wants to be clear and to explicate and to pin down as much as he can, but he always has this sense of the more that puts an asterisk beside any kind of more determinate claim you might make. Mm-hmm. And one last thing I might add, and this is something that really drew me in, because I think that, you know, both Father Ryan and I think part of the reason why we love Desmond so much is that he helps us make sense of life and maybe our own journeys through life, our spiritual journeys. And for me, it was Desmond's account of wonder and trying to restore wonder as the starting point for philosophy, but also for religion and art as well. And he gives us different modes of wonder, but the most basic mode is this sense of astonishment, this affirmative astonishment at the world. And in that astonishment, we might not sort of spell this out discursively, but we have this sense of the too muchness of being. And it sort of breaks open all of our sort of preconceptions again, all of our routines, and gets us to open ourselves again to this excess. And that really resonated with, I think, the kind of luminous moments of my own life, and sort of the ways in which I fall into ruts and routines, and my vision and my interactions with others can very easily become kind of numb and formulaic and self-enclosed. And, you know, he's always sort of calling us to reopen ourselves to that experience of wonder, prepare ourselves for it. And, yeah, try to do this ascesis where we, you know, get rid of those cloggings of our receptivity to it. That's also what sort of, as I handed off to Father Ryan, that's one of the reasons I read his book project back when it was a dissertation. And I was, this is such a great study of Desmond, because one of the things it does is it shows that he is offering us kind of a set of spiritual exercises to restore our openness to that too muchness of the world and to others and to God.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, Father Ryan, how about you? What would you say?
Sure. So it's your image of the dinner party that I want to jump off of. So if you think about at a dinner party, like you pass the bread basket around and we're your companions with bread, breaking bread with one another. And as the dinner, any dinner party progresses, you go deeper and deeper into conversation. So maybe passing acquaintances at the start of the dinner, by the end of the dessert course, you've become friends. And I think that's part of Desmond's allure, is he is a phenomenal companion thinker, and he models for other thinkers what it is to think along with even people he disagrees with. Say, Hegel, he's not going to buy into the whole of Hegel, but he is an appreciative reader of Hegel, of Kant, of Nietzsche, of Heidegger even. And what you get with Desmond as a companion is, and we've already alluded to, a very phenomenologically sensitive thinker. If Husserl kicks off what we consider like the modern phenomenological movement, and there could be debate about that, to the things themselves, Desmond's metaphysics says, yes, I want to go to the things themselves, but I want to go through the things themselves to the source of all being at all. Hmm. And part of that movement, so that's, he plays often on the double meaning of the Greek meta, meaning amid and beyond, so that being amid beings, going to beings, and allows us, when mindfully approached, to go beyond beings to the source of why there is anything at all. Answering the very first question that Heidegger poses, that what is metaphysics? Why is there something rather than nothing? That, you know, that. As I just happen to have it sitting on my desk, because I have to teach it next semester. Why are there beings at all instead of nothing? Mm-hmm. Well, what Desmond equips us with in so doing, and this I think is his genius, is he's a systematic thinker without trying to provide the system. And I think it's in his dissertation, the published version of his dissertation, Desire, Dialectic, and the Other, he gives a way of talking about the four ways of wording being. So if you think of, like, if you make a fist, the unifical mode of being, there's just measurable, manageable, it's own discrete thing. The second voice of being, say like with the Heraclitus, equivocal, you splay your fingers apart. Words can mean multiple things. It's very hard to pin down meaning. Hegelian dialectic, one hand grasping and encompassing the other, so that there's a recognition of alterity, but that alterity gets subsumed within a dominant narrative or in Geist or whatever. And then finally, Desmond's metaxological wording. And I think this is a beautiful way of thinking philosophically and theologically. It's more like a handshake. It's an embrace of what is other to the self without trying to reduce or take control or to colonize the alterity of the other. So it respects integrity. It can there's a reverence within that move. And so Desmond, what he offers is a way of thinking and a way of being attuned to the different voices of meaning and being in the world. And it gives us a really powerful way of identifying the strands of being and entering into a deeper and more meaningful dialogue for what it means to be at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's well said. That's wild that he was working on the fourfold senses of being even as a doctoral student. I didn't know that, but that's just crazy that even as a mere doctoral student, he was already, you know, working out this really rich and complicated kind of framework. Okay, since we're already kind of getting into this debate or this tension between metaphysics and phenomenology, we brought up Chrétien already. where would you say kind of Desmond's work sits kind of in that complex and kind of ongoing debate between these sort of two styles of philosophy? Maybe we'll start with Steve, and then we can jump to Father Ryan.
Yeah, sure. And I might just sort of jump in on two things that Father Ryan said that I think are really important for probably Heart of Flesh as well. The edited collection on Desmond and the Bible. So one thing is that I do love how Desmond is, he says explicitly in Being in the Between, he says that any great thinker is one that just can't simply be dismissed. They're kind of like perennially a conversation partner. So he does model this great civility and openness, even to voices that he disagrees with. So, I mean, sometimes I think you'll read things about Desmond and Hegel that makes it sound like he's just dismissing Hegel or thinks that people shouldn't read Hegel. And that's really not what he's about at all. I mean, his project has some very sympathetic things to say about Hegel and certainly is indebted to it, even as he takes things in a different direction. And in another way, I think that, you know, the other thinker that you engage so much in your book on Desmond, Father Ryan, is Charles Taylor. And that's something I've always been struck about both of them, is they kind of model how to think with someone that you disagree and to be charitable in doing it. The other thing that you said is that idea of the handshake that represents Desmond's view of the metaxological, that the goal of the philosophical system is to illuminate the communication between open holes. And this is also very interesting for thinking about the relationship between, say, philosophy and art, or philosophy and religion. He doesn't think that philosophy should try to colonize these or dictate to them from a position of superiority. Certainly there can be disagreements and challenges, but he thinks that they should be true dialogue partners, more along that line of sort of around the same table, talking to each other, others that should be respected and listened to and can't be just subsumed. And I think that's part of why he models a great kind of hermeneutic approach to literature in general, but also to the Bible, because, you know, a metaxological approach does have some concepts that you can bring to bear on a text, but it's not a set of cookie cutters that you're coming to the text and exerting on them and remaking them in Desmond's image. I mean, if you're following his own approach, you need to be listening to the text and allowing it to shape you, and always recognizing that you're not going to offer the final word or master the text. And if that's true of any text, of course, it's true in an even greater way to a text like the Bible that you're approaching as revelation or scripture. And also too, I mean, I think there's something kind of phenomenological even in that, and in that idea that there's an encounter here, and that your first task isn't to reduce the other to a concept. It's to attend to the other and how it discloses itself. But I know Father Ryan has written about Jean-Luc Marion and Desmond and can get into the weeds a little more on that.
Yeah, you know, I got to be honest. So if you would have asked me 6 years ago, I probably would have given him a very different answer, because I did my PhD studies at Boston College, and one of my readers was Richard Carney, you know, and Carney comes from, you know, it's Levinas, it's Ricoeur, and he knows everything, and he seems to know everybody as well. And he is friends with Desmond. And I remember during the dissertation defense, Richard had a throwaway line. He said, you know, if William would explain himself like this, I might be more sympathetic to metaphysics. And I mention that because I have a number of friends who I think they read What is Ontotheology by Heidegger and say, well, all therefore, so if Heidegger's right, then all metaphysics is ontotheology. Therefore, we don't need to, and ontotheology is like being a racist or a sexist. Yeah. We don't want to do that. So we're going to get rid of all metaphysics. And Desmond does not allow for that. And he really troubles that sort of narrative that says, that forecloses the option of metaphysics and says, well, the only viable way is phenomenology. And I think that people who struggle. I have friends who have written off Thomas Aquinas wholesale because, well, he does metaphysics, therefore he can't be trusted. And I just think that's callow thinking and horrendous. So I would regard Desmond as a figure of rapprochement who gives us a new way of thinking through what it means to be amidst other beings, that is attentive to the being is self-communicative, that there's a process of selving or self-expressing, picked up certainly in Hopkins, but also with roots down to Duns Scotus's notion of aseity, or even Thomas Aquinas, action is the revelation of being, that things are not just inertly there, but that there's that all that is addresses itself and speaks itself out to us, reveals and manifests itself, and that there's a disposition of receptivity we have to have on our parts to receive that phenomenon or phenomena. And I think that would be very much in keeping with Jean-Luc Marion, apocalyptic revelation. It picks up on Heidegger's aletheia, the disclosedness, and the more revelatory apocalypsis that Jean-Luc Marion so deeply prizes. But Desmond can be attuned and sensitive to all the concerns of the phenomenologist without discounting the big questions of being and existence and meaning of creation. And I think that Desmond is the most phenomenologically sensitive metaphysician who shows, I think, in a robust way, a truly Catholic both and. I can be both a good phenomenologist, and you can develop, and I think we need to continue developing Desmond's thoughts in a phenomenological key, at the same time being rigorously and very traditionally metaphysical in the most salutary and healthy way possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There is a, the William Desmond Reader has a couple pieces in it that are really, really good as well for the conversation we're having, which is John Caputo has an introduction in there, which is really, really interesting. It's short, but just because he's such a radical phenomenologist and is kind of operating in a, you know, very deconstructive mode, but he really explores kind of where Desmond sits between these two kind of styles of thinking. But then there's also Father Ryan, you mentioned Richard Kearney. There's an interview that Kearney does with Desmond at the very end of that book that's really, really wonderful. And of course, they both share, you know, their Irish heritage. So there's lots of good stuff about Irish literature and walking the coasts of Ireland in there. So it's well worth the read. And the Reader is only, you know, 250 pages or so. So it's not too dense. Okay, so let's, we've been talking a bit already about kind of the four senses of being that Desmond lays out, but maybe we could tease that out a bit more, right? He's famous for these four different senses of being that we've talked about, that he kind of sees being deployed in various ways kind of throughout the philosophical tradition and even the theological tradition. So kind of in brief, how would you describe or maybe kind of further elaborate what we've already described about these four senses of being? So maybe let's start with Father Ryan and then we'll jump to Steve on this one.
Sure. So I'm a total undergraduate teacher because everything has to have a concrete example. Desmond will look at the ethos or the current milieu in which we exist and say, look, there are different ways of reconfiguring given being, the created order. And these ways of reconfiguring can reflect certain certain voices of being. So a unifical voice is reductive. And we see this with reductive materialism. I think like a Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, very much the scientism. Everything can be reduced down to and managed and measured into its atomic units, or as Mary Midgley would describe the drive to univocity, like a radical univocity, as nothing buttery. You are nothing but an amalgamation of cells and water and muscles and tendons, whatnot. So it's trying to reduce everything to its lowest common denominator and say it's nothing but that. Then there are strands of equivocity. And I hate to say it this way, but like I find this with a reconfigured ethos that would reflect, I don't want to call it necessarily Oprah, but like a hallmarkization of live your best life, live your truth, own your truth, not the truth, but this kind of diffuse way of talking about reality. You know, you have your values, I have my values. It sort of redounds to this weird cultural narcissism. Taylor in Sources of the Self will talk about this. But equivocity, it's very hard to pin down any meaning. It's just a flux, a big flow, the Heraclitian flux in this case. You could then move to Hegel. He will, drawing on Hegel in this case, of a dialectic sense, where there's a recognition that there are multiple voices, but one voice of, or one way of talking about being is going to subsume all the others. And I think if in this way, you could say that our concerns about colonialism, one dominant group taking over and then taking control of a subgroup or another group of persons, that sort of dialectical subsumption would be reflected in that way of reconfiguring the world. And then finally, this metaxological sense, which, as I said earlier, it reverences difference. It doesn't try to subsume or control or systematize it, but it works to bring it into concert with one another. And here I would use my favorite example, and true to Desmond's heritage. If you go into an Irish pub on a Friday night, and there's going to be a bunch of musicians playing in what they call a session. There's going to be fiddles and flutes and illan pipes and at most one boron if it's a good session, and accordions and spoons. And all of these voices are going to contribute something. No one of them is going to dominate because it's not a solo show, but each instrument with its own integrity contributes to the whole musical event. And that's the metaxological sense of being, that it holds together in creative tension and creative and productive tension, all the different voices that have come before, unifical, equivocal, dialectical. It preserves what is best in them and brings them into a kind of a super whole that is more than just the sum of its parts. The metaxological sense allows emergent properties that are not to be found in any one sense of being, but when they're brought together, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Yeah.
Well said. Steve, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I think that's a great explanation. I might bring it back to the example of the artwork or maybe even the literary text. Again, you know, as a teacher, I think that you reach for those examples. And I think if you're teaching like an introduction to literature class, often students will come in and have one of two impulses about the meaning of, about interpreting literary texts. One is, I've got to find the meaning, right? There has to be one meaning here. That's kind of that univocal approach, right? Trying to pin down one meaning. And sometimes there are more sort of, there's scholarly hermeneutics, they're kind of based around that and maybe sort of anchoring it to like authorial intent or something like that. Could be this sort of quest for pinning things down to a more univocal meaning. Or a student might come in and be like, it's all relative. I can say anything about this poem and how could you grade me about it? Because anything goes, right? And that would be sort of absolutely equivocal, that the text is either so indeterminate that we can't pin it down, or it's just kind of like this empty figure that I project all my sort of disparateness onto. But either way, it's a very equivocal approach, right? But, you know, I think in good literary criticism, what happens is that you attend to the particulars of the text and you have this sort of ongoing conversation with the text. There's an intermediation. Certainly what you bring to bear, your training, who you are, your identity, where you are in life, that is going to affect your interpretation. But also the words on the page and how they strike you and how they speak to you and how they communicate, that's going to shape it as well. And I think that's a good example of what Desmond would call a metaxological approach, because You're not trying to claim the final word. You're not saying I've excavated all the meaning of this text. You're recognizing that it shapes you and you sort of bring something to bear on it, that there's kind of a back and forth, an intermediation that's ongoing and will continue to be ongoing. You know, if you return to the same text later in life, you'll discover different riches in it. And part of it's because you've changed, and part of it's because you see different things in the text this time that are actually there. And I think good literary criticism, yeah, it tends to the particulars, but also does realize that we're not pursuing univocal meaning, and that there's always sort of more that could be said. There's something provisional about anything that's said. Yeah, so I think that's kind of another good example than taxological.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, thank you. The images are very, very helpful, actually. Okay, let's jump to the title of the book. I'm curious why, Steve, you went with the title Heart of Flesh. And this might be more a question directly for Steve, but of course, Father Ryan, if you have anything you want to add, you're welcome to jump in, of course. But yeah, why a heart of flesh? Is this a phrase that's kind of coming directly from Desmond's corpus somewhere, or something that you came up with in response to his corpus? And then also how does it kind of apply to Desmond's way of kind of thinking in and around the Bible?
Yeah, thank you. So it does kind of come out of Desmond himself. He will sometimes use this heart language. And usually it's vis-a-vis one aspect of his philosophy that really appealed to me. We might call it more of sort of his anthropology, his picture of the human. So one of the things he says is that in modern thought, there's been this tendency to treat the human as a conatus, as a will, right? And that's what a human just is. You can put an equal sign between human and conatus and will for thinkers like Hobbes and Spinoza, and that continues to shape, I think, a lot of modern thought. And Desmond would say, yes, we are willing creatures. We do have will. We're desiring creatures. But before we sort of will and strive, we're receptive. We suffer, undergo being before we shape it or try to respond to it. We're open to being. And he says that we are a conatus ascendi. We are a striving to be, but kind of before that and alongside that, we're a passio ascendi, a passion of being, an undergoing of being. And there are many ways to think about that, but I always sort of use this idea of receptivity, because another metaphor he uses is porosity. And I think the passio ascendi, that undergoing of being, is also this openness, this porosity to being. It's this receiving of that excessive too muchness that I was talking about earlier. And it's pretty easy for us to sort of close that off somewhat, right? This is close to Taylor's idea of the buffered self, though Desmond puts the emphasis more on how anyone can kind of buffer themselves through habit, through just sort of getting closed in their own projects, that it's this perennial existential possibility and not just something that a historical epoch suddenly comes and we're all buffered. But we can never fully close ourselves off, and we can have these experiences of wonder that kind of blow our porosity wide open again, and we're blown out of our projects, and we see that we're back in this excessive world. I think experience of love are often like that, right? An encounter of love, if it's not manipulative or grasping, should reopen you broadly to being and sort of make you see that the world was bigger than it seemed before. So that idea of clogged porosity versus receptivity, I think that in the biblical image that often gets used for something very similar is the heart of flesh versus the heart of stone, the hardened heart versus the heart that's open to others, to God, that isn't just sort of willfully asserting itself. So that's kind of where a heart of flesh came from, is I think that there is something about that image that is very close to the heart of Desmond's own project. He's giving us, in some ways, an ascesis of the heart, among other things.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so we've had a chance to talk in pretty good detail about kind of Desmond's metaxological sense of being, and we've talked a bit about kind of Desmond's relationship to the Bible. So I'm curious for kind of those who have been influenced by Desmond's work, what does it mean kind of for them to approach the Bible while operating in this sort of metaxological frame that Desmond is famous for, and kind of what forms does this kind of metaxologically inspired engagement with the Bible take specifically in this book, in the contributions in this book, Heart of Flesh?
So I can in some ways blame Father Ryan for the book, because in his own book, Spiritual Exercises for a Secular Age, he has this passing remark where he says, I thought about writing a chapter on the parables in the Gospels as this. And I, you know, that got me thinking. I was like, you know, Desmond does talk about the Bible a fair amount. I think that he has some very useful resources for approaching the Bible. I think that metaxological approach, like I was talking about earlier, where you allow the text to speak to you and you approach it with a certain humility, I think that's a very useful hermeneutic for approaching the Bible. And I also thought it was interesting that he talks about the Bible a fair amount. He seems to do more so recently. Like his last book, God Sends, has a chapter on the Beatitudes, a reworked chapter about the prodigal son. So you see this biblical emphasis coming more to the fore, right? And of course, the whole notion of a godsend is bound up in this question of revelation in a broad sense. So it seems timely in Desmond's own career, but also it seems like an interesting idea for an edited collection, because it's something that Desmond explores but doesn't go sort of fully into that territory. So it means there's kind of a rich possibility there. I also thought it was kind of not that I'm an expert in sort of biblical studies, but it seemed like it might be a pretty good time in that regard too, because I think there's kind of a renewed interest in biblical theology. And I think that there's a renewed interest even from philosophy in sort of the philosophical affordances of the Bible. So I thought all those things might come together to make this a timely project. And thankfully, a lot of really, really great scholars agreed to contribute. And yeah, they model a whole bunch of different approaches. Some look at Desmond's own engagement with the Bible. So the first essay by Joseph Gordon certainly does lots of interesting things in its own right. But one of the things that he's doing there is building on Desmond's own reading of the creation narrative. I think others are sort of taking Desmond's approach and reading biblical texts that haven't been addressed by Desmond before. And then others are sort of taking up more sort of these broad hermeneutic questions about revelation, using Desmond as a dialogue partner.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is a really, really nice list of contributors. Father Ryan, is there anything you would add to that?
No, I agree completely with Stephen. I'm heartened and I'm humbled, really, to know that was that throwaway line. I remember writing it. And having, thanks to Stephen's initiative, the chance to revisit that topic. I think what Desmond contributes most to the reading of scripture is the reclaiming of voices. I mean, any one of us trained in like the historical critical method of biblical study, there's a certain way you read the text. And then having Desmond in the background of your mind, this really porous framework that you're listening in different ways as the text speaks on its terms rather than the terms we impose on it or expect to find within it, you're able to read it like extra canonically outside of the canon of received interpretation. Desmond allows the text to maintain its own integrity as a site of revelation. So to listen not only to the words themselves, but getting underneath and who is the God being revealed through this text? How does this text mediate and encounter a truly metaphysical text, starting with the physical artifact and pointing beyond itself to the source from whence it comes and the source it tries to reflect in limited words. It makes the biblical text an arena of encounter or a theater where something is being performed. And as a Christian, one could say it's a performance into which the listener is invited to put her or his own flesh and be transformed by it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well said. Steve, is there something else you wanted to add?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that that's so well put. I mean, it's something, and Brendan Salmon in his essay says something kind of similar that really struck me. He says something like, you know, there's no reading that doesn't bring some lens to bear. And he said one of the great things about Desmond's is that it's so sensitive and sort of is almost a way of checking yourself to allow the text to speak too, right? And there's no pure lens, but you know, it's just it's a hermeneutic that really is a kind of a humble hermeneutic, humble in the best sense of the words, not the sort of the way it humbles you used negatively now, but what way that allows you to approach something openly.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay. Let's turn to a couple of the chapters from the book, which are each of your own chapter contributions. So Steve, let's look at the chapter first that you co-wrote with Robert Wiley on 1st and 2nd Samuel. So in that chapter, you two speak about kind of this dichotomy between two different types of figures in Desmond's thought. So on the one hand, you have the tyrannical, erotic sovereign, and then on the other, the agapeic servant. So you and Robert Wiley are kind of drawing comparisons between those two figures, both in Desmond's own body of writings, but also kind of how these figures show up in the biblical text itself, especially in the Hebrew Bible. So could you say more about each of those two figures kind of as Desmond presents them, and then also where we're kind of finding figures that are sort of fit those molds within 1st and 2nd Samuel?
Yeah, so our chapter is one of two in the volume that's approaching kind of core narratives in the Hebrew Bible. So Ethan Vanderleek, who's a doctoral student at Marquette, has a really nice essay on the Abraham cycle in the volume as well. My essay with Rob probably is also the one in the volume that it has some biblical theology implications, but it kind of leans more, I think, towards political philosophy and kind of a literary approach to the Bible. And you're right, it's around this question of the erotic sovereign and how the erotic sovereign turns into a tyrant. And it's looking at the real ambivalence about kingship that runs through 1st and 2nd Samuel. We anchor it in the early chapters of 1 Samuel. You have Hannah with her canticle, you know, calling for this deliverer king. And then, you know, her son's going to lift that horn of anointing twice for kings. But his own first words about kingship are a big warning. He's like, kings are going to be awful. They're going to take away all your money. They're going to take your kids and get them killed in wars. This is going to be bad. So he's pointing out all of these tyrannical possibilities of kingship, whereas Hannah points out these sort of more the king that's going to lift up the weak, protect the weak, this more sort of messianic kingship. Mm-hmm. And what we say is that I think that tension between the two runs throughout 1st and 2nd Samuel and probably throughout the rest of the Hebrew Bible and into the Christian New Testament. Kings tend towards tyranny in the Bible. I think that we see Saul sort of sliding into tyranny, and then we see David as this very ambiguous figure sort of torn between tyrannical possibilities and possibilities of a virtuous sovereign, and then even maybe some hints of a more agapeic, right, sort of truly serving the other possibilities in him as well. And that's one of the things that's interesting about how Desmond sets things up. You know, he allows the sovereign to be a very ambiguous figure. A figure that's always haunted by the possibilities of tyranny, but also can go in these more sort of virtuous directions. And we thought that was a useful lens for David, because just as throughout the modern period, there's been this tendency to view humans as wills, there's also been this tendency to view humans as kind of calculating, will to power kind of figures. And David's been kind of read that same way. If you go right back to founding figures in early modernity, like Machiavelli and Spinoza, they give us a pretty tyrannical David. And certainly there's aspects in 1st and 2nd Samuel, but there's also more going on. We find David to be more interesting when you allow him to be this really ambiguous character with true conflicts and true successes and true failures. And we thought Desmond sort of allowed us to read him in that way. One last thing I might add is that we were also interested, Desmond turns to, so when he's giving his examples of the agapeic servant and the sovereign, he does mention in passing this tension between the kings and the prophets in the Hebrew Bible. So that was part of the influence there. But also when he's talking about tyranny, he usually is going to the Republic with Plato. And mm-hmm. there you see the tyrant becoming a tyrant because he has these voracious desires. And another thing that kind of interested us is that Saul's descent into tyranny seems very different. He seems to start with insecurities. It's those insecurities mm-hmm. that actually lead him into sort of paranoia. It's this lack of confidence, this lack of trust in himself and in God. And so we, you know, certainly I think that Plato's right, that that's one path to tyranny. But we also thought that 1st and 2nd Samuel can sort of expand these sense of tyrannical possibilities and paths to tyranny.
Yeah, no, it sounds like a very rich and fascinating read for sure. Okay, Father Ryan, let's turn to your chapter. I did get the chance to read both of these chapters, and Steve and Father Ryan, each of your chapter contributions, and both were really, really lovely. So I'm very grateful for the chance to read them. Father Ryan, so in your chapter, as we talked about already, you're kind of making this metaxological reading of Jesus's parables. Engaging, you know, not just William Desmond, you know, as kind of offering a frame to read the parables, but also the New Testament scholar Gerhard Lohfink figures pretty prominently in your chapter as well. So could you say more about what you're trying to do in that chapter, and particularly how you think Desmond's metaxological metaphysics might kind of afford a helpful lens for how we could read the parables that we find in the Gospels?
Sure, thank you. The core interest I have as a theologian is to find new and better ways to think through some of the key features of the Christian tradition. And that certainly must take account of the Bible. And as a teacher, I find my students are often familiar with the parable tradition as received from Jesus. Most of us know at least the idea of the Good Samaritan is. We get the idea of a pearl of great price, but I think they are so well worn and so familiar that they've lost their edge or their bite. And my hope was to read them through a metaxological lens to start to uncover some of not only how the parables work as Jesus shares them, but also the depths that those wee tiny stories are concealing. And so, you know, Desmond will talk about, and as Steve has already discussed, the conatus ascendi, the passio ascendi, the conatus, the striving for being, the passio, the undergoing of being. Mm-hmm. And those are very metaphysical categories. And what I've been trying to do is work out, well, if we transpose metaxology into a more theological key, one where divine grace and big R revelation are occurring, what I think happens through the work of the Holy Spirit is what I took to calling the passio caritatis, the passion of charity, a way of being drawn by grace into God's own life and to see not a different world, but to behold the world differently, to see the creation's hidden depths. And I think that's what Jesus's parables do. They become narrative events that erupt and reconfigure how we see the world around us. So whether it's the parable of the prodigal son or the wheat and the tares or the pearl of great price, the parable of the mustard seed, there is a way that receiving a parable enacts what you could call like the treason of charity, that you are betrayed by God's love and that betrayal liberates you from a sinful, distorted way of viewing the world and coming to see the world as God intended it to be. So what's happening with the parables is they become metaxologically read windows into the way God intended the created order to be, the way the primordial or the ethos of the kingdom should be, but for being disfigured through human sin, through sinful conatus ascendi, that tries to that distorts the world around us. Undergoing the parables, undergoing charity, liberates us into a new way of living and being and acting, and as animated by that, by those stories. And so we become what we receive. We become little parables, showing what, giving a glimpse of what God's kingdom looks like in here and now, so that they're not, the parables aren't stories just told way back when, but they become living narratives enacted by us today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can attest, having read both the chapters for, you know, for our listeners, you know, these two chapters alone are worth the price of admission for the book. So I would highly encourage you to take a look at them and to take a look at the book as a whole. I want to give you both a chance as we close, Steve and Father Ryan, to share about any works you have in progress or anything else you might want to plug here. So Father Ryan, let's start with you and then we'll jump to Steve.
So my book, Theology of Horror, The Hidden Depths of Popular Films, will be published by Notre Dame this calendar year. I think the ads will start coming out in April. I'm waiting on the cover art. And I'm right now working on, in keeping with the theme of horror, a text co-authored with another Jesuit, Father Cahill Doherty, here at Marquette. And I would like to call it The Devil's Advocates, but it's a metaphysical and theological consideration of the phenomenon of exorcism. And my hope, there are plenty of books on the history of exorcism and the rite of exorcism and accounts of exorcism. But what I'm more interested in is I want to read these accounts with a hermeneutic of charity and say, all right, I'm gonna grant that what you're saying is true. What conditions must obtain within the world, metaphysically and theologically, for these accounts to work? So I want to work backwards. If this story is true, what must the world really be like? And I can tell you, just like I teach a lot of first year students, they do not give a lick about the kingdom of God, but they do care very much about demonic possession. In fact, when I teach anymore, I tell them, like, you may not like this class. You may not think anything about the Bible or divine revelation, but when you are possessed, who are you going to come and see? When you need an exorcist, you're going to be knocking on my door. So at least humor me for now. But that seems to be a topic that they get into. So that's my next research interest, in addition to things like I'm teaching a doctoral seminar in the fall on Rahner and Heidegger.
Oh, fascinating. Okay. Thank you very much. Steve, how about you?
Yeah, so thanks again for having me on. And I wish we could have said something about each of the essays in Heart of Flesh, because I think they all are wonderful, and I'm so grateful to the contributors. So yeah, thank you for giving us the chance, and I hope that people will get it and check everyone's work out. So later in the spring, or actually it's probably going to be in the summer, I have a co-authored critical introduction to the contemporary philosopher Byung-Chul Han coming out from Polity Press. So I co-wrote that with Robert Wiley, who's a frequent co-writer of mine. He co-wrote the chapter in here. He's a political philosopher at Ashland University. And then with Ethan Stoneman, who's a media theorist at Hillsdale College. So my chapters for that project focus on his account of the other and his account of time and how we recover time as duration. So I kind of focus on his contemplative solutions to, he's a big diagnostician of the ills of the digital age and sort of screen addiction and things like that, that I struggle mm-hmm. with myself. Mm-hmm. So I think he's a really worthwhile thinker, and it's been very rewarding to spend some time with him as well. And then I have one final sort of Desmond specific volume that I'm working on, one other collection of essays that also is under contract at Cascade, that's tentatively titled Intimate Strangeness of Poetry, William Desmond and Literature. And I have roped Father Ryan into that one as well. Looking forward to that. The plan is that the essay drafts will come, chapter drafts for that will come in over the summer, and then you'll work through the editorial process. But so probably that won't come out before 2025 at the earliest, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. All of those projects sound lovely. I think Somebody's got to find a way to get Byung-Chul Han and William Desmond in the same room speaking of roundtable conversations. That would be very, very interesting to listen to. Okay, as we close, where can our listeners find each of you? Where can they learn more about your work? Let's maybe give Steve a chance and then Father Ryan.
Yeah, for better or worse, I'm on Twitter or X, so you can find me on there pretty readily. And yeah, you can just Google me, and various essays that I've written will pop up.
Awesome.
I'm on YouTube. I teach Irish music on YouTube, so if you type in Brian Dunn's SJ, that still comes up. I'm on X at Dunn's SJ and Marquette University.
Awesome.
Teaching away.
Awesome. Lovely. Well, thank you both very much for taking the time today. Again, the book is A Heart of Flesh, William Desmond and the Bible. Thank you, Steve and Father Ryan, for coming on. Appreciate it so much.
Thank you for having us.